This is I Choose Life News and Views, sponsored by Indiana Right to Life and Allen County Right to Life, committed to defending innocent human life for all people of all ages. Your hosts are Kathy Humbarger,
Abigail Eschelbach,
and Scott Kump.
Welcome to I Choose Life News and Views. I'm Kathy Humbarger.
I'm Abigail Eschelbach.
And I'm Scott Kump. I Choose Life News and Views is a joint project of Allen County Right to Life, Indiana Right to Life, and Bot Radio Network in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
And now, the pro-life news.
We just learned that Planned Parenthood of Indiana and Kentucky is asking a federal court to stop Indiana's Dignity for the Unborn law, our new abortion law that we've been talking about so often here on this radio program. Joining us by phone is Indiana Right to Life's president and CEO, Mike Fichter. Mike, your thoughts.
Well, it isn't surprising. Planned Parenthood operates abortion clinics as a business. And in Indiana alone, this is a $2 million plus business per year for them. So basically what we see here is an abortion business stepping in to say, we don't want any regulations or restrictions on abortion, including any protections for children with disability, children based on their race, children based on their sex. This is all about protecting the business side of their equation, protecting their money. So not surprised to see Planned Parenthood weigh in on this. This was expected. So, disappointing, but we are confident that the Dignity for the Unborn law will be found constitutional. And we are optimistic that not only will it withstand this legal challenge, but that this law is going to create a historical basis for the civil rights of those unborn children with disabilities, or to protect unborn children based upon sex or race. We think we're on the right side of history with this. And we believe the courts will show us correct.
And Mike, what is so important about this specific piece of legislation is that it could be a model for the rest of the country. This is literally groundbreaking, and we shouldn't lose sight of that as we consider Planned Parenthood, the largest abortion provider, not only in the state of Indiana, but across the country, being the complainant in this legal challenge. Tell us a little bit about why this is so important, not only for the state of Indiana, but across the country.
Well, it's important because it touches at the very core of the civil rights issue of unborn children, especially those with Down syndrome and disability. But it also touches on the humane disposal of aborted babies, and the Dignity for the Unborn law also touches on preventing harvesting of organs and body parts, as we saw in the Center for Medical Progress last year. So there are multiple streams all playing into this bill. This bill has touched the very core of the abortion industry. That's why they're responding so violently to this. That's why they're responding with angry calls and just obscene calls to elected officials and others across the state. Now it's turned into a lawsuit on this. And I think it's very interesting to note, Kathy, that the abortion folks out there, they can't win this battle on logic. They can't win it at the polls. They can't win it at the state house. They cannot win it in normal public policy discourse. So what they rely upon are activist judges to try and rule in their favor to block laws like this from happening. So that's exactly what's happening with this right now. And at its highest level, this is the spiritual battle in its very visible format. As Planned Parenthood attacks this new law, they're attacking people who support this law. And we just really need to pray for protection and favor for our pro-life legislators who supported this, especially Governor Pence, and just be there and stand firm and know that we're on the right side of history with this thing. And let's trust that the courts get this thing right and that these kids with disabilities are protected.
Mike, would it be an overstatement to say that the Lord may be using the least of the least of these to create a crack in the wall of the abortion business across the country?
I think that's a powerful statement that you just made. And I think that very much so, that could be what we're seeing happening here. And I remind folks in times like these that in 1857, when the Dred Scott case was decided, it looked like a devastating blow to the abolitionist movement in the United States. And yet 6 years later, President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, ending human slavery in the United States. We could be on the edge of such a historical moment right now. So this legal battle, we expected it. We knew it was coming. It's going to the courts. And we're just praying at this point that what Planned Parenthood means for evil in protecting abortion will actually turn around and be used in just a way that we can't even imagine right now to start an entirely new phase that becomes the end of abortion in the United States.
Mike Fichter, Indiana Right to Life President and CEO, thank you for being with us on short notice. I know that we'll have much more information to share with our listeners on this court challenge, and we look forward to having you back for an update real soon.
All right. Thanks, Kathy.
In February of 2015, the UK's legislature made it legal for scientists to create three-parent embryos. Earlier this month, an article crossed my desk saying that President Obama is now pushing the FDA to allow the same in the U.S. A technique developed in 2012 called CRISPR, or C-R-I-S-P-R, which edits the human genome in a way which is inheritable, is making this possible. In vitro fertilization, or IVF, and human embryonic stem cell research are two areas in the pro-life arena which can be hard to talk about. Infertility and genetic diseases affect people we know and love, which makes it difficult to clearly see the lines of what is morally right and morally wrong when it comes to scientific research in these areas. Lord Howe of the UK told the House of Lords, "Families can see that the technology is there to help them and are keen to take it up. It would be cruel and perverse, in my opinion, to deny them that opportunity for any longer than absolutely necessary." So we begin to see where the argument gets difficult. With us today as our guest is Michael Cook. He's the editor of BioEdge, a newsletter about bioethics, and MercatorNet. He also writes a bioethics column monthly for Australasian Science. Michael received his bachelor's degree in English from Harvard University and a PhD in Australian literature back in Australia. He now lives in Sydney. Thanks so much for joining us, Michael.
Great to be with you, Abigail.
You have a phenomenal accent for being born in the U.S. I love it.
It's a very expensive surgery.
And how long have you been living in Sydney now?
Oh, goodness gracious. I've lived other places in Australia as well. So Melbourne and Hobart is a few years there. So probably longer than I'd like to divulge to your listeners.
Oh, all right.
That's about 20 years or so.
Okay, great. When you lived in the U.S., before Harvard, obviously, where were you from here?
From Boston.
Okay.
Great. On the East Coast there. It's a bit warmer down here, so.
Well, I should hope so, yeah. So before we start into really CRISPR and editing the human genome, I'd love to paint a little clearer picture of who you are and how you came to be the editor of BioEdge. Obviously, you have a degree in literature, two of them. But as far as the actual biology and bioethics piece of it, when did you realize that bioethics was your passion?
Well, I've always dabbled in journalism, and I worked for one of the newspapers here for a while and as a reporter. And so I've always been writing on various issues, and my passion is really more ethics than bioethics as such. But in 2001, if you cast your mind back then, Bush was president, and one of the first big controversies of his first term was to decide whether or not to fund human embryonic stem cells. Mm-hmm. This was something that had come up during the Clinton administration, and scientific advances had proceeded so that suddenly there was a huge push from scientists to use embryos as the raw material for research. Mm-hmm. So Bush came up with a compromise in August 2001. And just by coincidence, in August 2001, we got some funding to start up a newsletter. So my first sort of entry into the bioethic debate was to publish a couple of articles in newspapers here about Bush's decision. And that was really one of the first time, I think, that a lot of people ever heard of bioethics, because it was on the front pages of the paper, every day, every week, because what stem cell research offered was the possibility of near miraculous cures for a whole range of diseases and conditions. Your listeners might remember Christopher Reeve, the star of Superman, who came off a horse and broke his neck and became a quadriplegic. And he became an ardent advocate for human embryonic stem cell research. He even came out to Australia. He was promoting it around the world. He founded a research institute and so on. And that stem cell debate became extremely heated when it was in Congress. It even affected some of the elections in various constituencies in the United States and so on. People were debating that. From a kind of journalistic perspective, that was a very exciting time, but it was also a very dangerous time because I think it was the first time that people were really debating was the possibility of genetic engineering, of changing the human genome and so on. So that was a very important and very vigorous debate, which we're still having, really.
And so what was it about that that really grabbed you, that told you, I need to do something about this? I need to write about this?
Fair enough. It's the ethical issue there. I mean, the embryo is the human being. People were arguing at the time and still argue that, you know, the embryo is much smaller than the head of a pin. How can it be human and so on? Well, the whole world is much smaller than the head of a pin in terms of the whole universe, you know, but it's still significant. And everybody was a human embryo once.
Right.
And everything an embryo develops into who we are now, you know, so there's only a change in appearances between the embryo and the person we are now. Scientists regard, on the other hand, the alternative point of view, you know, sort of roughly speaking, is that the embryo is raw material for scientific research, scientific curiosity. And with good intentions of healing and helping people to and with their fertility and so on, they want to exploit the embryo as a kind of mining the embryo, as it were.
Right. You know, it's interesting that you use that term raw material. I was reading an article out of Salvo magazine today on this, and the writer quoted C.S. Lewis, who said in The Abolition of Man, if man chooses to treat himself as raw material, then raw material he will be. And I feel like that's maybe sort of the track that we've been following lately, and it's a scary one.
Yes, C.S. Lewis was really prescient. He and other writers, you know, saw that sort of man was disappearing in a sense. You know, another issue which is doesn't appear to be related, but really it is, to say, the issue of surrogate mothers. You know, women are using their capacity for motherhood not as a way of showing love for children and so on, but turning it into a pure commercial enterprise, and often they're being exploited by a whole market for their wombs. This is one of the great issues in bioethics, or one of the things that makes me very interested, is that there's a gradual trend to exploit the human body and treating it as a kind of quarry for useful materials. Organ donation, for instance, it can be a very noble thing, but that's why we need to think about these issues carefully so that we make the right decisions.
Right, because there's a large difference in between, say, this embryonic stem cell research and being an organ donor.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, that's why we can't be against all innovations in science and so on. But the human person is always has inherent dignity, and we can't look at a person, whether he's conscious or unconscious, disabled or abled, and look at them simply as a way of making scientific progress or medical advances.
You mentioned in our conversations earlier that as far as the bioethical discussion goes, the focus has really been shifted over to a new technique for editing the human genome that's called CRISPR, or CRISPR. Could you explain to us that a little more? Because I've read about it, but it's still pretty new to me.
Unless you have a degree in biology, CRISPR might be a little bit obscure. The CRISPR stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats.
That's a mouthful.
So that's awesome, isn't it? But we're not getting very far with that. But the technique, though, is something which was invented, after a lot of background, of course, in 2012. And it allows scientists to target a single gene or a single bit of DNA and remove or replace it. So this has enormous implications in any sort of biology. For instance, it can be very, very advantageous in say, plant science. So if you want a new strain of wheat, which is drought resistant or bug resistant, you could insert a gene into this strain of wheat, or the one application that occurs to me at the moment is the mosquitoes spreading the Zika virus in Brazil and other countries in South America. Perhaps if you targeted the mosquito, you could make it infertile, release lots of mosquitoes, get rid of the mosquitoes, the Zika virus fades away, and so on. So it's tremendous possibilities. But scientists also saw immediately that this was, this is the moment which will allow us to genetically modify human beings. And last year, Chinese scientists published a paper in which, to everybody's shock, even the scientists were quite shocked by this, but the Chinese took IVF embryos and used the CRISPR technique to alter the genome. The scientists were really amazed by this. The results were not good.
Oh.
Most of the embryos did not develop. They found also that the technique sounds great, targeting a single gene, but it's still not, it's more of a shotgun effect than a rifle effect. You're aiming at a single gene, but the CRISPR technique at the moment could possibly hit other genes as well randomly. So they discovered that while some of the genes, some of the embryos developed as they anticipated, others were modified in other spots as well, and so on. So it's still experimental technique, which is one of the reasons why the head of the National Institutes of Health in the United States has said that this shouldn't be, for the moment anyway, that they're discouraging any kind of use of CRISPR on human embryos.
Yeah, I think I was reading about that study out of China and that it was pretty disastrous for most of the embryos involved, that either it wasn't snipping the right portions of the DNA, or it was snipping too much, or it was fragmenting it and then not replacing it all the way. Is that the
same?
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Well, the thing about that is, I mean, this obviously this, they will keep improving the technique until they get it right. So in a sense, there's a time to reflect upon it before people start to think that, wow, we can actually use this. At the moment, it's experimental.
Yeah. So you mentioned using it on plant life and using it kind of in the environment, in maybe animal life. You mentioned the Zika virus in the mosquitoes. Is any of that being done yet? I mean, they have to be experimenting on something, but as far as actually applying it.
This is a huge area. So it's really going very fast. The CRISPR research is one of the key areas in biology at the moment. So if you're doing CRISPR research, you're very likely to get funding for it. So eventually they will probably get it right.
Okay. Can you explain to us kind of the link between the CRISPR technique and the three-parent embryos that we've been hearing about lately?
Yeah, certainly. Three-parent embryo sounds quite bizarre, and it is quite bizarre, really. But the first time it was used was actually in New Jersey, I think in the 90s.
Oh, okay.
There's an IVF lab there, which was off. IVF clinics are always looking for new marketing techniques, and they were trying to market a technique which involved turbocharging the cytoplasm of the mother's egg. So they thought, well, if the mitochondria is not working well and so on. So they used this for a while, and then the FDA not long ago just told them to stop because it could be dangerous. But in England, or in the United Kingdom, the three-parent embryo came before Parliament after a long 2 or 3 years of discussion. Mm-hmm. Now, what's at stake here? Some children are born with mitochondrial disease. The mitochondria is a genetic form which floats in the cytoplasm of the egg. And scientists describe it as a kind of power pack, which helps to boost the cell's performance. If there are some defects in the mitochondria, then there's a range of effects upon the children. Some of them are very minor, hardly noticeable. Others are terribly disabling. Children who might not live until, beyond 2, 3, 4, 5, others who live much longer but with serious defects. But these are very rare, but okay. It provided scientists with an opportunity to appeal for research directly upon the human embryo. So what they proposed was, okay, this embryo, the result of a mother and a father, and the mother's the mitochondria exist only in the mother's cytoplasm, so it's inherited only from the mother. So the mother's mitochondrial DNA is defective. So what we will do is to get an egg from another woman who has perfectly normal mitochondrial DNA and insert that by a couple of techniques, insert that into the embryo. So the embryo will develop with a genetic heritage from the sperm of the father, the egg of the mother, and the mitochondrial DNA of a second woman. So the idea is that now the child, who otherwise would have grown up with this defective mitochondrial DNA, now has healthy DNA, and the couple will have a healthy child. So that's the promise.
Which sounds wonderful until you come to the ethics side of it.
It sounds wonderful. The thing is, what scientists don't say all the time is they talk about the wonderful bits are their promises. They don't talk all the time about whether they can actually do it or not. This is experimental, and there has obvious ethical problems. And first of all, whilst the scientists say that, or the scientists in favor of it, because there are many scientists who are not in favor of it, the scientists say that it's just a little tiny bit of DNA, it doesn't make any difference. Mm-hmm. But the DNA may be very tiny, but if it can cause enormous birth defects, it's very powerful.
Right.
So
yeah.
It's a part of a person's genetic heritage. And so you literally are creating a person who has effectively the genetic heritage of three people. Mm-hmm. You could say three, two mothers and one father, but it's not quite. We don't have words in the English language to quite express the relationships there.
Right.
But they do have three parents. What concerns me is that this is a precedent. There's a precedent first for destroying embryos, because in the course of this, you know, one or two, or probably a whole number of embryos will have to get destroyed, because these techniques, as I was saying at the beginning of the interview, are, you know, use embryos as kind of a quarry. So a successful procedure might only use two or three embryos, but, you know, instead of 20. So they regard that as great progress. But they will always end up using embryos. But with this CRISPR technique, it will be possible to do all sorts of rearrangements of DNA. One of the things that I find quite, well, horrifying, really, you know, is the fact that with this CRISPR technique, it may be possible eventually to create sperm and eggs from any cell in the body.
Oh.
So, for instance, a gay couple, obviously, they have at the moment they have to hire a surrogate mother in order to get the maternal component of their child. But if they could go to a lab, give a DNA swab, and then the lab will grow eggs developed from a male genome. So then, you know, one man's genome could be used to develop the egg, and the other man's the sperm, and then they could have their own babies, right? You know, so this is on the cards. This has been done with mice in Japan, and in a very, you know, very rudimentary fashion. But people have already written quite a few articles about it. So this kind of the three parent embryo sets a precedent for that kind of procedure. And in general, the genetic manipulation of embryos in any fashion whatsoever. So that's why I think it's so, well, I don't want to paint too dark a picture or anything, but I mean, it's almost a bit sinister, because I think there's an agenda which extends beyond three-parent embryos to genetic engineering of any kind.
Yeah, which is where we start getting into the designer baby.
Well, now with this CRISPR technology, that's no longer science fiction.
Right.
It's a real possibility. Although, as everybody serious has pointed out, designer babies, we tend to think, okay, I'm going to make a child who can run an 8-second 100 meters or something, you know, or a great football player or another Einstein. Those sort of genetic heritage, that kind of genetic heritage involves so many genes that it's almost impossible to achieve. But you can get genes for eye color, hair color. Single gene effects will be marketed eventually. So we have to start thinking about the ethical implications of all this science immediately.
If someone wants to know more about your writing, if they want to read your articles, they want to read BioEdge, where should they go for that?
Just Google the word BioEdge, BioEdge, and you'll find the site pretty easily.
Oh, great.
You can sign up. We have a little box there for giving us your email and so on. We're always happy to get new subscribers, and we send out a newsletter every weekend. And then occasionally we have interviews with bioethicists and so on as well.
Oh, great. Yeah, I know for me, as I was reading the different articles that you had, I found myself kind of pulled down a wormhole into your BioEdge site and started reading all sorts of articles in there. It's really interesting things that you have written.
Sometimes it's a bit depressing. But anyway, you know, this is a very interesting field. There's so much to read about, and I think people have to realize how much is at stake in some of these scientific advances, which have tremendously good effects, but they can also have very damaging effects for human dignity.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us today here on I Choose Life News and Views. And thanks, listeners, for tuning in. Michael, it was a great pleasure speaking with you, and thanks for enlightening us.
A great pleasure, Abigail.
If you or someone you know is in a crisis pregnancy, help is just a phone call away. Call 877-791-5475. If you or someone you know is dealing with grief and pain after an abortion decision, call 877-791-5475. You'll be referred to a crisis pregnancy center in your area, a place where free and confidential services are available. That's 877-791-5475. 877-791-5475.
You've been listening to I Choose Life News and Views. If you have questions about this program, or if you'd like to support the fight for life, please call 260-471-1849 or go to ichooselife.org, because without the right to life, no other rights matter.